Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Andy Probst. He's the author of the new book, You Fascinate Me So, The Life and Times of Cy Coleman. We review Skylight at the John Golden, Pantagon at the Booth, and Iowa at Playwrights Horizons. That plus some more. Please stay tuned. And welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 12, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade, which is out and available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. What are we doing for the Great Parade? Are you having any promos at the Drama Bookshop or anything?
Yeah, one is coming up next month, and the month after that at Barnes & Noble. So as we get closer, I'll give you definite dates, but those will be happening.
Great. Excellent. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Andy Probst is with us. Andy has written a book called You Fascinate Me So, The Life and Times of Cy Coleman. And we want to welcome Andy to Broadway Radio, and thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning, Andy.
Thank you so much, James.
So, Andy, before we talk about the book and Cy Coleman, let's talk about you for a minute or so. I know you from way back at the American Theater Web.
Yep.
So tell us, what's happened in Andy Probst's life in the last couple of years?
In the last couple of years, I've continued reviewing for American Theater Web. And at the same time, I've been wanting to write for quite a while something longer. And so that's where the books come in. But I continue to see about 150 shows a year.
Wow. Okay.
Everything from Broadway on down to off Broadway. Then at the same time, I've been working on this project and getting A Life and Times of Cy Coleman out.
Well, that is, it's quite an accomplishment. I mean, some of the things that is talked about in the book repeatedly in your book, You Fascinate Me So, is that we all know Cy Coleman's music, but we really don't know the man. And you've really gotten behind the music and told us some wonderful stories about the man. So what's one of the stories that surprised you the most?
I have to say, I think my favorite one comes from a gentleman named Jess Corman, who's a playwright and writer who was working with Cy and Dorothy Fields in the late 60s, right after Cy and Dorothy had written Sweet Charity. And they were working at Dorothy's apartment somewhere on Central Park West. And Cy was late. And the reason he was late became apparent when he came rushing in and said, we're not going to be working today. You've got to listen to this. You've got to listen to this. And he had under his arm or in his hand Sergeant Pepper. He made them sit there and listen to all of Sergeant Pepper. And what I love about that story is that, at this point, Cy had written things like Witchcraft and The Best Is Yet to Come and musicals like Wildcat and Little Me and Sweet Charity. And yet he was still listening to pop music like Sergeant Pepper and felt that that was just as important. Mm-hmm. And I think that says volumes about Cy and his ear.
Which is interesting because although he's justly famous and very, very highly regarded for writing, being able to write musical theater scores in a wide variety of styles, I guess he never – maybe the life would be the closest exception to sort of modern-day pop. Mm-hmm. Am I forgetting something?
No, that sounds good to me.
Yeah. Okay. But that I'm not surprised to hear that story at all, Andy. That's great.
I think that, you know, there's pop sprinkled in throughout all of his scores. I mean, if you listen to something like I Love My Wife, it's a bit like spinning a radio dial for the mid-70s. you've got some country western in there. You've got the light pop of Sexual Revolution. And then there are the Broadway-sounding things, but it even goes even further back into something like Barbershop Quartet. Psy enjoyed playing in a whole bunch of different styles, and I think that's one of the reasons that people don't necessarily know him as a man behind so much of this music, because it always sounds so different.
Right. All right. There has never been anybody who has worked with so many female lyricists. Is there a penchant for that? Is that just accidental? Did he enjoy working with women more than other people did? Do you have any sense of that?
I think that Psy enjoyed working with good wordsmiths. And I think that what happened was that as he began his career, he wasn't necessarily looking at either pop songwriting or Broadway musical songwriting. He was perfectly happy to be working in jazz clubs. And he was thrown together first with Joseph McCarthy Jr. And they wrote Why Try to Change Me Now, which became the Sinatra hit. And then they got a little bit of work doing a couple of one-offs for reviews in the mid-50s. And the songwriting bug kind of hit. And I think that the stories about how he started with Carolyn Lee and then Dorothy Fields were simply that he was wandering around in the first instance, the Brill Building, and suggested to Carolyn, why don't we try writing a song? And the story goes that they found an office with a piano in the Brill Building, decided that what they were about to do was a moment of madness. And within the next few hours, story goes, they'd finished that song and it became a Sammy Davis song, a hit. And he approached Dorothy in the same way. But during that period, which would be from about 1956 to 1963, Psy did experiment with other lyricists, including Floyd Huddleston and Bob Hilliard. And I think that he just had so much music coming out of him that if somebody was willing to help him along with the words, he was quite comfortable with that. And then ultimately, he began in the mid-70s working strictly with the male lyricists. After Home Again, Home Again, all of his shows were written with guys, be it Michael Stewart, David Zippel, and then
Ira Gaspin
for The Life. So I think that the women thing to me feels like it was just a fluke more so than anything else. Fine.
I asked him that direct question once, and he basically said, you know, more or less the same thing, that it was all about the talent. And I guess he had obviously a very good experience with Carolyn. And then, of course, the major difference between Carolyn and Dorothy Fields is that Dorothy Fields was already extremely well established. So it's, the fact that she was a woman in that sense was almost immaterial.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Now, Andy, when Little Me was in Philadelphia, there's that famous story of Carolyn Lee being upset with Psy Feuer and going out and getting a policeman so that Psy couldn't change her work. Do you have any idea what Psy Coleman's reaction was that? Did he think it was funny? Did he think it was appalling? Is that when he said, this is it for me and Carolyn, I'll never work with her again? Do you know anything about that?
What I know is that Carolyn didn't ask just that the policeman or the traffic cop, the stories vary, to arrest Psy Feuer, because she felt that the illegal action was that her contract rights under the Dramatists Guild had been violated. She also pointed apparently at Bob Fosse. Mm-hmm. And said that he needed to be arrested too. But what amused Cy was that she did not point at him. In terms of that being the final straw, I think it contributed to a lot of antagonism that had been a part of their relationship, as my understanding goes, that dated back almost to the time they started working together. Cy Coleman, there's so many Cys involved here, would say that Carolyn got very jealous of the fact that he wanted to continue his work as a performer, even as they'd begun their collaboration together. And in the book, I have a story from Cy in which he talks about how he came to have the contract to write musicals with her. And he said he'd been very straightforward and said that, yes, I will do this, but I also want to continue my career. And the agent had agreed to that wholeheartedly. Carolyn had said yes, but then basically reneged, that she felt that he shouldn't be going to London House in Chicago, for instance, when they could be working on something. Mm-hmm. And so there was that going on underneath. And then by all reports, the rehearsal period for Little Me itself was very stressful. And in particular, that the song that by all reports was being changed was the first act finale, mm-hmm. that no one knew how to make the first act of Little Me work. In addition, they did three opening numbers for the second act, and the final one being Poor Hollywood Star, which is what we know. So they were working really hard, and there were a lot of very forceful personalities all pushing. And I think that finally, that the fact that Carolyn in retrospect said, oh, our egos were so fragile and we were just, you know, fighting on that level too. And they just couldn't work together. And at the same time, they never stopped working together. From 1963 until she passed away in 1982, there are songs that they wrote together about every 5 years, mm-hmm. Starting with one almost instantly after they quote-unquote broke up, I mean, Pass Me By, for the movie Father Goose.
Father Goose, yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. All right. I can appreciate that. That sounds like a very good explanation. Do you think that is – well, let's put it this way. If you had anybody to talk to who was no longer alive, who would you have most liked to talk to?
I would have liked to talk to Carolyn.
Mm-hmm.
I would very much have liked to have spoken with her to find out what it was like when they were starting off. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have heard about – The fragile egos. That's a quote that comes when they got back together just before she passed away to do the Little Me revival. Mm-hmm. There's a big feature in Newsday in which, you know, this great reunion was touted and the reporter was talking to them both simultaneously. And what was funny is that in Cy's files, I found a letter that had been sent off by his attorney to folks involved with the original Little Me, in which it was explicated where names needed to go. And depending on the format, her name was sometimes first, sometimes his name was first. And this letter detailed that, you know, if it's the cover page of the Playbill, it has to be like this. If it is a window card, it has to be like this. And so that to me said, yeah, what Carolyn was talking about was indeed part of it, but I would have liked to know a little bit more about what her problems were with Sod.
Well, mm-hmm. correct me if I'm wrong, please, but I seem to recall reading or hearing that she was considered not terribly stable.
She was a feisty and not stable would probably be a good way of putting it, woman. There's one story that I could not get any corroboration on, that the breaking point between them came when they were having a songwriting meeting and she got so upset she threw an ashtray.
Ah.
That has been floated around. I could not get any corroboration on it. When I interviewed Carolyn's sister. I asked if she had ever heard this tale. And I don't believe I'm telling tales out of school. She said to me, well, I never heard that, but it sounds like it could have happened.
another reason not to smoke.
Boy, you know, I'm looking through Cy's credits on IBDB, and I did you know this, that he wrote music for the play Equus?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure you
I'm
know
sure
it.
Andy would know that, yeah.
It's a cinema music. Isn't there a scene where Alan, the boy, goes to the movies with the girl? Is that what happens?
They do go to the movies, but it's not just the movies. They go to a skin flick.
So right.
The cinema music is actually what I've begun to think of as Cy's porn score. And it is extant. The music that was used in the production, they pulled it for me off of reel-to-reels at Cy's company Notable Music. Mm. And I am going to totally blank on the guitarist who performs it. It's the guitarist who also did the theme music for the original Airport. So it's that really heavy electric guitar stuff. It's some of the creepiest music that you might ever want to hear. Mm. And just so people can get a sense of this little known bit of music and so much more of Cy's, I have put a sample of it up on the site that goes alongside the book, youfascinatemeso.com. And if you go to music and you surf through, you'll find about a 40-second sample of the Equus score.
Oh, that's great.
Vinnie Bell?
It is Vinnie Bell.
Mm-hmm. The guitarist?
Yeah, the guitarist, yeah.
All right. Now, you mentioned this gentleman he was working with, the Sgt. Pepper album era. Obviously, that's a show that didn't come off, right?
That is correct.
All right. Of all the shows that you heard about that did not happen, what was the one that intrigued you the most?
I have to say it's that one.
What was it?
It was a musical called The Coffee Lover, and it was based on a comedy that Jess Corman and Stephen Canfer had written that played up in Westport about 1966, and it starred Alexis Smith. And it was this play about a gentleman who had a very, very, very successful career doing the voiceovers for commercials on TV. And one night he is in the studio doing the commercials while the show's happening, and he has a snap. He just realizes his life isn't worth anything. And she's out in Ohio visiting family, and by the time she gets back, he's sold their suburban house and bought a derelict building in Greenwich Village that he wants to turn into a coffee house. He's decided he wants to become part of the new movement in the village. And the play is all about what happens as he tries to start this up. There's the cop that's on the take. There's the cop's daughter who wants to become a flower child. And there were reports that it was going to come in just as a play. And when that didn't happen, I believe it was Arthur Kantor optioned it for a musical and put Cy and Dorothy on it. And in the process of it getting expanded into a musical, it became what I think could have become the third piece of a triptych of shows that Cy would have done with Dorothy about New York in the 60s. It started off with Sweet Charity and then would have ended with Seesaw. And this one was interesting because late drafts began to have multimedia aspects in it. They wanted to do a lot of projections about the TV. They were beginning to propose a ballet sequence, a dance sequence that would have been for all of the television execs as they had their expense account lunches. And several songs that we know from Cy. have come forward, that have moved forward. For instance, after 40, it's Patch, 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 which Kay Ballard did on her The Ladies Who Wrote the Lyrics album. And which some people know was supposed to be in a subsequent musical, unproduced, a musical about Eleanor Roosevelt, actually started off in The Coffee Lover. And it was the wife sitting around the home, which had not been sold in the musical, and talking about what happens to women in middle age. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, Poor Everybody Else, which ended up in Seesaw, and it started off in Sweet Charity, they found a place for that in The Coffee Lover, and it was the wife singing ironically about how happy she was with this new lifestyle in Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. And it's a side of Cy and Dorothy that I don't think shows up in any of the other musicals.
Well, Andy, I want to thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning and telling us about the book. You fascinate me so. The Life and Times of Cy Coleman can be found at Better Booksellers, as well as Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. Its official release date is a couple of weeks from now, right? The 28th?
The 28th. Amazon might start shipping it earlier, but that is when they will start shipping for sure. There have been some issues.
We have some. We'll have a link to it on our show notes page if you want. And it's published by Applause, which is part of the Hal Leonard Corporation. Who Applause and Hal Leonard are such huge supporters of Broadway and the arts. So we have to support them as well. Mm-hmm. So Andy, thanks for joining us, and let's come back and we'll talk about some other stuff. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Right, so let's reflect upon last week. The beginning of last week on Monday the 6th, Peter, you had a reading of your show, Adam's Gifts. How did that go?
Oh, very well, thank you. Dan Lauria was really sensational playing my Ebenezer Scrooge character. He's not Ebenezer Scrooge. This is an update. And as a result, I do not deal with very much of A Christmas Carol, but my feeling is that this event that happened to Ebenezer Scrooge way back when does not represent an isolated experience. I believe that there are ghosts that come every day of the year and do this work with miserable people. Now, of course, the problem is, you know, there are so many miserable people around that we can only have one ghost do past, present, and future because there aren't enough ghosts to go around. It's also a way of keeping the cast size down too, isn't it? So as a result, I have a completely different issue on what made this man terrible. It's not just a Christmas play. Christmas is barely mentioned in the show. But anyway, Dan did very, very well, which was basically a cold reading. And Lisbeth McKay, who we know from Crimes in the Heart, was excellent as the ghost. So that was really good. Hayden Wall, who is an excellent child actor, he was the Soul Doctor not that long ago, once again reprised his role that he did in a small production we did at a church last year. As Adam, the Tiny Tim character who changes William Pront's life. We also meet his parents, essentially the Cratchits, and they were wonderfully played by David Arrow and Danette Holden, who I've known for a long, long time because she went to the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. And Aubrey Berg, who runs that program, always says that he really concentrates on acting as well as singing and dancing, and Danette really proved that by doing a wonderful job in acting the role of essentially Tiny Tim's mother. So I think if we live long enough, we'll see it produced, but we have to live long enough. That's what has to happen. So maybe you'll see it, James. Maybe I won't, you know. So
for God's sake.
We'll see what happens.
I tell you, Peter, if I win Mega Millions, it's getting produced.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I make this promise publicly and with no reservation.
James, do you play Mega Millions?
I do.
There's always hope.
I only play Mega Millions if it goes over 100 million, because what would I do with only 50 million?
I understand.
You could barely live in New York with only 50 million.
Speaking of Mega Millions, I'm not sure if it's that one specifically, but there's a commercial for one of those lottery things that a friend of mine is on, and the wonderful actor Robert Fornaro from The Sopranos. Have you seen this one? It's this guy is out somewhere and he meets this beautiful woman, and they're talking and seems like they're really connected, and he asks for her phone number and she gives him the number.
Oh yes.
And he calls the number and you hear Sal's Pizza. That's my friend Bobby Fornaro.
But he takes her phone number and he plays those numbers.
Yes, he does.
And he wins.
He takes a lemon and makes lemonade.
Exactly. All right, so Peter and Michael got a chance to see Skylight on Broadway. So Peter, why don't you tell us about the opening of this show?
Yeah, it's a revival. It's almost been 20 years. It doesn't seem possible, but it is. And so here we are seeing Skylight, this time with Carey Mulligan and Bill Nighy in the leads. And David Hare's play does stand up. I will say I like the original production better, but this one still holds a good deal of interest because Carey Mulligan is really sensational in it. I like Bill Nighy less. That was Michel Gambon who did it originally. The premise is that she and he had an affair once upon a time while he was still married, very much married. In fact, she lived in the house with them. Here they are, you know, all these years later, and suddenly he shows up at her door. And, I mean, what's it like when a former lover who you really thought was out of your life and it was over, you didn't have to think about him anymore, he really was in your past, turns out not to be in your past. And that's a very intriguing premise. So I think David Hare deserves a lot of credit for coming up with an idea like that. So there's also a complication with a son. But the real thing that's interesting about the play to me is that these are people from two completely different worlds. He's interested in money, and it's very nice that David Hare didn't make him a banker or a captain of industry. He's a restaurateur. He has a few successful restaurants. You know, she, on the other hand, is teaching and pretty much appreciating the fact that she is changing lives and making lives better. That means nothing to him, nothing whatsoever. And there's a real shocking thing he does towards the end of the play that really shows the contempt he has for what she does for a living. Altogether, you know, this adds up as a play because you do have these two completely different people who were attracted to each other, certainly sexually. I mean, he does have a way about him that does make you think that you should be interested in him in the way that he wants you to be interested in him. Okay. However, you know, I mean, that only lasts so long. So, but still, one of the things that Bill Nighy does that's amazing to me, he's almost Ethel Merman-like in the way that when he delivers lines, he looks at the audience more than he looks at her. That type of cheating, as it's called, is just excessive. And it really seems he's playing to the house. So that's one reason why I didn't like him very much. But I did like Carey Mulligan substantially more than I like Leah Williams, who was fine. But this is really an excellent performance. It's funny that some of the play shows its age in the sense there's talk about yellow ties. I remember when yellow ties were all the rage, you know. There's
our ties.
Yeah, and there's also a funny inadvertent irony when he points out the fact that she doesn't have a television set. And to him, this is just unbelievable. Anybody could live without a television set. And he says to her, "You're missing reality." Well, now she's missing reality shows, you know what I mean? So that's kind of interesting as well. All the time she's doing this, she's cooking. And by the way, that meal smells great. I tell you, I want to go right up there and have some of that meal. So that was that. The play does end on a more hopeful note because we do see that there's someone else in her life who does appreciate what she's doing. And that's kind of nice. So a play that intoxicates us in many ways. It doesn't feed us. I wish it would. But it intoxicates us. And under the circumstances, I wish it well. The irony for me was going in and seeing the playbill.
Go on.
The playbill is almost like playbills of yesteryear. And I mean, I'm talking about going back to the 50s, 60s, 70s. Because today when you go to a Broadway show, what you see inevitably is the logo. Well, there was a time when they used to put pictures on the playbill. And this one has a picture of the two of them on the playbill. Not only that, there was a very distinctive typeface that they used to have the name of the play in white lettering over the photograph. And that's there, too. The only difference is, even though the playbill itself in yellow at the top is different from every other playbill you'll get on Broadway, it still isn't quite what happened way back when. What used to happen, there used to be like an inch square on the left-hand side where they put the name of the theater. They don't quite do that. But this does look like a very retro playbill. And I was delighted to go in and see a playbill of yesteryear being handed to me.
You left out one more distinctive thing about it. It bleeds to the edge of the page. There is no border.
Yeah, and, that's right. That's right.
And it's funny. I sat two seats down from Andy Probst the other night at Hand to God, and I said, Andy, did you see Skylight yet? And he said, yes. And I said, did you notice the playbill? And he said, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we both remarked on how retro it looked. And I was wondering if maybe playbill had changed globally, you know, gone back or changed the design to this. But and I was almost disappointed to go to Hand to God and get the
conventional
playbill.
One, yeah.
Let me tell you a total aside. Last night I was at Wolf Hall. All day yesterday I was at Wolf Hall, and I saw Robbie Rozelle and Blake Ross, who are both work at Playbill. Mm-hmm. There, and so we were talking in the aisle, and the usher came up the aisle and offered them playbills, and they looked at each other and they were like, "No, we've got enough.
We've got
thank you." it was very funny. Anyway, go on, Michael. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, no, it's I really loved. So that's so interesting. I mean, what prompted the producers or whoever to say, "Oh, we'd like a different cover. We don't want a border, and we want it's obviously their choice to use a photo. Can we think of any other play that has had a photo recently? I'm sure there must have been some.
I sort of feel like there's another show this season that might be using a full bleed retro. Because I saw folks, this new trend of when you go into a show, people take a picture of the playbill and post it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I saw another playbill that was full bleed. I wonder if they were both Skylight. But
well, oddly enough, you would think that they might use aside from that. Oh, here's one. The audience has a photo. I mean, it's a photo of her. It's got a logo also. It's not just it doesn't look like a production shot. So I guess that doesn't really count.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, they really should have used a big photograph of Bradley Cooper in Elephant Man. That would have been a collector's item.
And that was a very limited run, so they didn't have to worry about changing it when he left. But I guess they had they wanted a reveal or something. Anyway, Peter, I agree with a lot of what you said. Congratulations on the correct pronunciation of restaurateur, by the way. So many people put an N in that.
And sure, why wouldn't they, though?
No, why wouldn't they? It seems natural. And no, but also the reason I bring it up is that was like the one tiny flaw I noticed in Carrie Mulligan's performance. She definitely put an N in it. So I thought that was interesting. But she was just wonderful. I thought she was great. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I did see the 96 production also. For whatever reason, I remember liking it at the time, but I didn't have a very clear memory of it. It didn't stick in my mind so much. I'm going to attribute it to the fact that maybe I was a little too young to appreciate the situation, the stories and the characters. And also, who knows, maybe I just didn't have a good night or whatever.
Sure,
but
sure.
Boy, this time, you know, the best thing I can say about the play is that it keeps your interest every second, even though it's fairly long. And not only are there only three characters, but no more than two ever appear in any one scene. And also, and one of the three, the son, played by Matthew Beard, is only in it for a relatively small amount of time at the beginning and then at the end. So the bulk of the evening is
Carey Mulligan and Bill Nighy, and I thought they were great together. I did notice what you said, Peter, about him playing to the audience. To me, it was not so much playing to the audience, although, of course, that's what the effect was. But he kept whirling around and kind of directing lines everywhere, sometimes to her, but sometimes to the wall, sometimes to the ceiling. It was a very showy performance, but I personally thought it worked brilliantly to communicate the very special kind of charisma that this guy has. So I can understand you being distracted by it, but I personally responded to it very well. I thought he was just great, and I really think it is a wonderful, wonderful play by really one of our best playwrights ever, David Hare. I'm so glad they brought it back, and a nod to Stephen Daldry, the director, who I think he just really tends to do excellent, excellent work in just about everything I could think of that I've seen of his. So I'm very happy about this production.
All right. So that is Playing at the Golden in a limited engagement, as they say. I wonder how limited it will be if they win some awards, but we'll see. Right now, I think they're just kind of scheduled through beginning of June. Next, were you going to say something?
Oh, I just noticed because it's opposite the title page in the playbill there. Carey Mulligan is apparently starring in a soon to be released remake of the film Far From the Madding Crowd. Which to me, I've never seen, but it sticks in my brain because I seem to remember that Julie Christie won an Oscar for it. Wait a minute.
No, that was for Darling.
That was for Darling, but Julie Christie was in Far From the Madding Crowd, wasn't she?
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Carey Mulligan, Matthew Schoenaerts, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge are in a remake of Far From the Madding Crowd, so that should be interesting.
Interesting thing on the Skylight website is that their rush tickets are available for $37 on the day of the performances, ages 30 and under only. How do they prove that?
Well, ID, I guess, driver's license. I mean,
maybe.
I don't know if they ask you to show them. Maybe if they think you look under 30, they won't ask you.
I have fake ID that says I'm 17. The reverse fake ID. This is the new things these days. Yeah. All right. So the three of us got a chance to see Hand to God this week. And Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I was afraid you were going to ask.
Well, I could start us off.
Would you?
Why don't you?
Yeah.
All right. So Hand to God. I had a very good time at Hand to God, and my wife hated it. And I tried to find out why my wife hated it, and it came back to the choices that were made by the characters in the relationship that she wanted the characters to do something else. I really don't want to be specific and give away what happens in the plot lines there. But I thought that the show was irreverent, and I thought it was very, very funny. And I think that it can be offensive to some folks, and we did see some folks leave.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, don't you have to research these things before you come in? I mean, if I thought that it was very funny, and I could see how seeing it in its previous incarnations that folks could say that this is a Broadway property. I think that it's going to get done many places in many regional theaters after the Broadway run is complete. I'm not quite sure it would tour very well, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought that maybe the last 10 minutes went a little too far. But I'd like to hear what both of you have to say about the last 10 minutes of the show.
So, all right, I'll jump in, given that Michael wants to go last. I think Hand to God is terrific. I enjoyed it the first time I ever saw it on Ensemble Studio Theater. I think that's where it was. It was certainly on this upper floor of a building in the West 50s. I was asked by Roy Miller to come see it because he wanted to produce it. Alas, Roy died much too young, 52, and that didn't happen. But last year at Manhattan Class Company, I certainly had a wonderful time again. I am amazed at Stephen Boyer. I cannot believe what he's accomplishing, because he not only has to give a whirlwind performance as this tortured teen, but he has to deal with the puppet as well. And his work with the puppet is hilarious and astonishing. So I hope he gets the Tony. I think he truly deserves it, because this is a yeoman effort. I don't think you'll ever see a performance like this on Broadway again, because he has to do two things, not just one, but two. And he is worth it alone. However, yes, James, you're absolutely correct in saying that this is a play that can certainly offend people. And I thought it was very interesting towards the end of the play, and maybe this is what you mean by the last 10 minutes, a woman came out with a three-word expression that criticized God. And there was silence in the house, that perhaps this was going too far now, because the two adjectives that were blank, blank God, there were two adjectives applied to God that the audience didn't want to hear at all. There was not even one peal of laughter from a single theater goer. So I think that was certainly indicative that you can only go so far with this. What the play is about is the fact that there are these people who meet in a church basement, and it's a religious organization, and they're putting on a puppet show that's supposed to praise God. Well, it doesn't quite work out that way. And we find that there's one very surly teen who just isn't having any of this. He's not interested in what's going on at all, and makes it very clear every step of the way that he is not going to be anything but profane and argumentative, which certainly frustrates the woman who is running the puppet show. And she's very frustrated with him, but her frustration comes out in a way that you might not expect. By the way, for the record, this is Michael Oberholzer as the young man Timothy, and Geneva Carr, who was very good in a play at Westport last year, an Alan Ayckbourn play where I saw she was terrific, and she's terrific here too as the leader of the group. Also, Mark Kudisch, a terrific performance by Mark Kudisch as a pastor who has designs on Marjorie, as the lady's name is, and he's sincere about it. But what's certainly the factor that comes in here is she wants no part of him. Part of that comes from the fact that her husband is only dead for 6 months. She's a widow. But the other part, too, is she just doesn't have a feeling for him, and that's it. She lets him down gently, and he is furious. You know, and here's a man who supposedly loves the world and loves everybody, and he's very religious and all that kind of stuff. And he turns out to have a little more sinister side, a dark side, as we all do. So there's no question we're taking pot shots at religion here. We're taking looks at hypocrisy in religion, people who really don't believe what they're saying, and all that's going on. So this may not be a commercial show. I don't know about regional theater, simply because it's so hard to do that stuff with the puppets. If there were no puppets in the show, and we'd certainly miss a lot if there weren't, yes, I could see it done here and there in regional theater, but this is, I think there'd be more walkouts in the rest of the country than we've seen here. I didn't see any walkouts yesterday when I went at the matinee, but it was really an audience that was up for poking holes in religious beliefs, and people who are so staunch about it and think they have all the answers and believe there's only one way to live your life and there's more to it than that, that it's a very simplistic view, as they were all with it until those three words. So I don't know. Maybe it's a good idea to omit those three words. It'd be a good idea. So, Michael, you're on.
Reminded me of that line from Gemini. Do you recall the line? I mean, Peter.
No, I don't. What?
All right.
Do not say it.
I will say it, but just be. The line is "Fuck you, Catholic Church." was kind of it's kind of not dissimilar to that line.
Not. Yeah.
So
we're not talking about Wolf Hall until next week.
I haven't seen it yet, but I can see where that would be the case. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I they don't say that, do they?
No, but obviously, if we're dealing with the time of Henry VIII,
but it's the British. They're much more polite than that, but that's what they really mean.
That is what they really mean. Obviously, if we talk about Henry VIII. So anyway,
I definitely noticed that too, and so many things I noticed. I'll try to be brief. I noticed that it seemed like the audience was a little stacked. There was somebody or more than one person in the back who kept starting applause for every scene change, and someone who seemed to be kind of leading laughter in places where it wasn't necessarily appropriate, even though I didn't think that was called for at all, because the audience seemed to be doing a lot of laughing on its own and didn't need anyone to kind of goose them. So I don't know. I didn't get a chance to check and look back and see if I recognized anyone doing that, but I really felt that to the point where it was very obvious to me, and it kind of annoyed me, to be honest. I had such mixed feelings about the play. I guess I'm somewhere between Peter and James on one end and James's wife on the other. I enjoyed a lot of it. I completely agree about Stephen Boyer. I would hate to be up for best actor in a Tony this year, but I would even to vote for them is going to be difficult, because just off the top of my head, Stephen and the fellow from A Curious Incident, they're such extraordinary performances, not only in terms of the talent, but just the energy expenditure. Mm-hmm. And they're resting up when after the shows and stuff.
Yeah, because I said to the person I attended with yesterday after it was over, because it was a matinee, I said, and he's got to do it again tonight. You know,
incredible. I mean, there are other plays like that, but this one is really extraordinary. He deserves every award possible. That doesn't mean that other people don't also, but it might be one of those cases where you wish that there could be multiple awards for best actor, because so many good people, but he really is great. Geneva Carr I thought was great also, but I was very concerned about her voice. Did either of you notice that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was very raspy.
Yeah, I mean, she does a lot of screaming, and there were times when it was really raspy. So does Stephen Boyer do a lot of screaming as Tyrone the puppet, but I only noticed once or twice when I felt that when I heard it in his voice as a rasp. We didn't actually say the main crux of the play, did we? Jason, played by Stephen Boyer, has this puppet on his hand named Tyrone that seems to almost never leave his hand. And Tyrone is very, very foul-mouthed. And the question is whether he's supposed to represent the devil, or maybe he's supposed to represent a vengeful god. And Stephen has to just keep continually switching back and forth between them, lightning fast switches, manipulating the puppet in the meantime. So this is why Peter is over the moon about his performance. It really is absolutely incredible. And also, for the record, I this is only the second thing I've ever seen Stephen Boyer in, but the other thing was when he played the fool in King Lear in the park. And I know that he's a great actor even when he does not have a puppet. So I just wanted to say that for the record. The play itself, I had, again, very mixed feelings. You know, it just occurs to me that if you have puppets, talking like longshoremen and cursing up a blue streak and having sex with each other, that's just going to naturally have an effect on an audience. So I think in that way, it's kind of an easy out. I'm not going to say cheap, but it's just you could write anything, the lines could be anything, but if you have puppets cursing and screwing each other, it is going to, you know, result in uproarious response from an audience. So
as they say in 20th century, but.
Okay.
But. The thing is, when Stephen Boyer is having his puppet have sex with Sarah Stiles' puppet, the point is that both of these people cannot have sex together. They just cannot make that leap. And these are the vicarious ways that they are having sex. It's the best that they can do. And that's what makes the play very interesting to me. The fact that, you know, I don't know if you remember in the 70s, there used to be this oil filter commercial in which the point is, if you don't change your oil filter, you know, you're going to be bad off. Anyway, the tagline was, you can pay me the oil man, the car mechanic would say, you can pay me now or you can pay me later. And the point is, that's true of sex too. You know, I mean, you know, sex wins in the end. If you don't have it early in your life, you're going to want it desperately later in your life. I mean, it's very important to get that all out early. You got to have a past where it comes to sex. And the point is, there are some people who just do not acknowledge that, and they pay for it later when they start doing silly things and when they're much too old and they shouldn't be doing things like that because they should have got it out of their system. Well, these people have not got it out of their system remotely. I mean, and they don't know how to handle it, but sex wins. Sex wins.
Well, yes. No, I completely agree with that, and I understand that. I think, and also we should say that the facial expressions,
oh my God,
on Stephen Boyer so and funny. Sarah Stiles while during the sex scene are absolutely priceless. So that really helped it be an kind of incredible moment. You know, I had a little bit of trouble figuring out how old these kids were supposed to be.
Yeah,
I, in the beginning, I wasn't sure if they were supposed to be playing much younger kids, but then that seemed not to be true when several things happen. I guess it's partly because the place where they're rehearsing or whatever looks like a childhood classroom, an elementary school. But I guess they're supposed to be like teenagers. Like
I would think juniors and seniors in high school type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's
right. But it looked like, you know, it was – I think that the Kudish character, the
pastor,
exactly, yeah. Mentioned that it was the church basement, and that you, in church basements you very often have childcare classrooms and things like that.
Yeah, multi-use, no question.
At one point, I forget if it was before or after that one character has sex with another. She says, you're a child. So that was one of the places where, you know, but I guess she just means younger than 18.
Right, and in terms of development, be sure. This was the third time I saw it, and I believe I laughed harder this hard time than I did the other two times, maybe even put together. So it's a play that wears well with me, I'll tell you.
Has it been the same cast each time, Peter?
No, certainly Stephen Boyer. I think the only new one is Geneva Carr, I think that's it. The rest, I think, are the same. I'm not sure if Mark Kudish did it in that first production. I saw it Ensemble Studio Theater, if indeed, as I say again, that if that's where it was. But still, the people who have the biggest parts seem to have stayed with it or have been allowed to stay with it.
Yeah, Kudish was terrific also, I have to say. And yeah, as I said, the audience was alive with laughter when I went. So I think that all the more reason why I I felt that goosing that I noticed was completely unnecessary.
I have to go back and listen to our interview with Kudish and see if he had mentioned Hand to God back then. I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean,
did or not. But I was thinking about having him back on again to talk about Hand to God, and then I figured we'd have to set aside another week or so to do that.
Yeah.
All right. So next up, Peter got a chance to see Iowa at Playwrights Horizons. So tell us what's happening in the flyover country, Peter.
Well, I wish that I could say you ought to give Iowa a try, but I really can't. This is a crazy show. It seems like what struck me as this is Chris Durang's first play that he wrote when he was four. It's really off the wall, and I'll be damned if I can really tell you what it's about. But it does start out with a mother being very much involved with a man she met on Skype. And now, as a result of that, she's in love with him and she's going to move to Iowa. This does not sit well with her teenage daughter. Not that the teenage daughter has so many friends. She has one friend, but she's going to miss her terribly. So it takes a long time before we get to Iowa. It's a 95-minute play. There's no intermission. That's what playwright Jenny Schwartz has given us. And along the way, you run into things like a pony, who has a very nice song, by the way. There is a little bit of music by Todd Allman. He wrote the lyrics along with Jenny Schwartz. But it's almost absurdist. It's almost Dada. One thing seems to have nothing to do with the other. And I was very much itching to get out of there. So it wasn't for me. It's the type of play that seems totally undisciplined, but I will concede that sometimes these plays that are seem totally undisciplined really are very disciplined if you really get a chance to really examine them. But you only get a chance to see these things once, at least most of the time. And as a result, I was quite bored and frustrated by what this play was. This is not a Playwrights Horizons main theater. It's upstairs at the Peter Sharp. And I didn't feel the audience was with it. Every now and then something absurd would happen and they would laugh because it was so incongruous. That's where this play gets its laughs, from being incongruous, from pulling things out of the air. And I mean, like, you know, there you are watching the play and suddenly a guy runs across the stage with a horse head on and a tail. You know, I mean, that type of thing, you know, and you didn't see it coming and that's why you laugh. A lot of that in this play. You can't say it's sophomoric, it's freshmanic, if there's such a word. I don't think there is, but I'll coin it for this one, because this lady certainly has written a play that is so bizarre, I don't feel it's out of bounds to use a bizarre word to describe it.
That's a great word.
All right, so that's playing at the Sharp, as Peter mentioned, through May 10th. And we'll have links to that in the show notes as well. So before we wrap up, let's just mention a few things that has come up in the news this week. The closing of Mamma Mia. And I got a few emails that that said, well, aren't you happy? All of these people are going to be out of work.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm not happy about these people being out of work. But, Mamma Mia has played for 14 years, made $2 billion in grosses. It's had a great run. And, you know, it's...
And I'm sure those people will have other opportunities.
Exactly. Well, you know, and that's my other point is that, you know, Mamma Mia is, is going to close. But there's 30 or so Broadway shows waiting to come in and that, you know... I don't know. If I had $1 million to bet, I would bet that the Broadhurst Theater is not going to sit empty. What do you think?
Absolutely,
you know?
Not. Yeah, right. It's a prime house.
And it's a really well sought after house, and that when the Broadhurst is filled with another show, which I'm sure will happen very soon, you will have the equal relatively the same amount of people employed, and I don't think that there's a huge downside to that. And
also, someone mentioned that it's not closing till September, and how many people get 5 or 6 months' notice on the fact that their jobs are going to be ending?
Oh, it's the announced thing is September. I wouldn't be surprised if it extends to January, unless they have a tenant that it's the Cats closing, which Cats coming back.
Yeah. Even My Fair Lady announced a closing and then extended. Now I'm talking about the original production way back when.
So
that even happened too. So nothing new.
I hear whispers of Heidi Chronicles closing. Having very, very bad grosses, coming in last week at 49%. $275,000 in grosses, and that it's doesn't seem like it's it. You know, if they keep having those numbers, especially what happens now is you have a lot of openings and you lose that, you know, that buzz because there's so many things going to happen all at once. So I wonder, you know, what's going to happen there as well. But what else to mention?
Oh, I wanted to mention to listeners, you have about a week left to see the Musicals Tonight production of Pardon My English, the Gershwin musical, music by Ira Gershwin, lyrics by George Gershwin, libretto by Herbert Fields and Maury Riskin, which I really wanted to mention it again because I think this is one of the best they've ever done, because primarily because the cast is so strong across the board, but especially Tyler Milleron in the role of Golo / Michael and Gillian Gottlieb in the role of Frida. These are the two who get to sing Isn't It a Pity, among other things. And they are both Broadway caliber. And it's not a show you see every day, although it was done at Encores and very well, I might add. But it's got one of the most ridiculous plots you've ever heard in your life, but the lines themselves are hilarious and the songs are by the Gershwins. So you really, you know, it's worth it. Let me tell you.
I saw it too. And in fact, I even did talk.
Oh, that's after. Right. Yeah. Yes.
And I agree with you. I would also point out that I like Colin Ryan quite a bit as the commissioner. I thought he was excellent. He was very much into his role as well. Yes, Pardon My English, which doesn't show up every day, in case you aren't familiar with Musicals Tonight. Yes, people carry binders and they certainly read from them. Though, like Uncle is every little bit more, you do see that people are, when they do the songs, they tend not to use the books, that they memorize the songs. By and large. And so it is a terrible plot. And yeah, it's a ridiculous show. But yes, I do think Isn't It a Pity is one of the great show songs of all time. And it's very nice to hear it done so well here. And it gets reprised a bit too, which is rather nice. Mel certainly puts them on. For those of us who have missed these shows from years ago, he's been a very valuable resource in letting us see what these shows were like when nobody else is tackling them. So yes, this one is not quite the case because Encores did do it, but the one previous Hazel Flag, never in my lifetime have I been offered Hazel Flag before, and I certainly jumped at the chance.
Right. And yes, thanks for mentioning Colin Ryan. He was hysterical. He had, to me, a John Larroquette quality that was...
Yeah, that's right. I could see that. Yeah.
That was really great. But across the board, I felt everyone was just wonderful.
I agree.
All right. The last thing I want to mention before we run for the day is that there was an announcement out of the Tony Awards community that they're making three special awards this year for one of my favorite people in the world, Adrian Brian Brown, who is a press representative. Folks out there that don't know what press reps are, some of the listeners have emailed me over the last couple of weeks and say, you know, when you guys say stuff, you kind of glaze over it and assume that we all know what you're talking about. So I wanted to point out that a press rep is somebody who is hired by the producer, general manager, a company that handles, you know, the public-facing statements of the production. And Adrian Brian Brown from Bono Brian Brown is one of Broadway's top press reps. And what they do is they represent a number of shows on Broadway. And it's interesting when a press rep might end up representing two or three or even four different shows that are in competition with each other for a Tony Award. And they have a very hard time because they have to put the best face forward for each one of their clients. And and the press reps have they do very difficult work because sometimes it's on the face of it is very easy to do, but it's sometimes very political. The Tony Awards also announced that Arnold Abramson and Gino Donovan are going to get special 2015 Tony honors for their work in the theatrical community as well.
And we should mention that not only is Adrian going to get this well-deserved award, but his wife won it was last year.
It certainly in the last 2 years. Yeah, yeah, Joan Marcus, a wonderful photographer.
Yeah, one of the best, one of the few, but also one of the best regular production photographers of Broadway and off-Broadway shows.
All right. And before we run, the last thing that I want to do is that one of our listeners, Andrew Belinfante. Oh, I'm not sure if I pronounce this correctly. Andrew, please forgive me. Andrew listened to last week's podcast about ways to see Broadway shows a little less expensively, and he sent me this huge email about ways to see Broadway shows less expensively, and I asked his permission to put it on the show notes. So I'm going to put it on the show notes this week. So if you want to check out Andrew's suggestions, they're all really wonderful suggestions, and I agree with them. Check them out at BroadwayRadio.com.
That's great.
Yeah. So we're going to do a trivia question in a minute, but before we do that, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many different ways. One of the ways is a Stitcher app, which is an application for your BlackBerry, your iPhone, your Android device. And that way, our show will be streamed directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about. Last week, I asked some folks to go over to iTunes and leave us some good reviews, and we've been getting those. I would like those of you who haven't done it, please jump in there and leave us a good review, because good review on iTunes will help other people find us a little bit more easily. So, Peter, do you have an answer for last week's question?
Yeah, but one thing I want to say is the question involved, what was the first two record set of a Broadway musical? And the key words are Broadway musical, because, of course, one might say opera, you know, that type of thing. And I, you know, because certainly the Menotti things would apply there. But I really think that I've just contradicted myself, because I realized that what I should have said was what was the first two record set, period, because what I'm going for is Greenwich Village, USA, which was an off-Broadway show in 1960. It wasn't a Broadway show at all. But who would expect that a show called Greenwich Village, USA on 20th Century Fox Records would be the first one to preserve on two records? I mean, that's really bizarre to me, because you would really think a mainstream Broadway show would have got it. Of course, The Most Happy Fella in 1956 got three records. The entire show was captured, which is something that's always fascinated me, given that it opened only a few weeks after My Fair Lady. And you would have thought that if anything would have got the full treatment, it would have been My Fair Lady, which was a substantially bigger hit than The Most Happy Fella. But of course, the reason is, as Frank Lesser said, it's a musical with a lot of music. And that's one of the reasons that they went to three discs. Still, they could have done two discs and got all the music and not put on all the dialogue, but anyway, I digress. For this week, once upon a time, there was supposed to be a musical by Livingston and Evans, the guys who wrote O Captain and Let It Ride, and it was titled Kentucky Lucky. Who was it about? That's the question. Who was it about? Who was the main character?
Wow. Well, for the cast albums thing, I mean, I did immediately think of Happy Fella, so I was wondering, well, is that why he specifically worded the question as two rather than three? Yeah. And I guess the answer is yes.
That Felicia, he's clever.
And of course, back in the 78 era, there were, you know, like six records.
Right.
Six records.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, good point. Good point.
All right. Well, you know, back in the 70s, one of the things that Andrew, who wrote in about inexpensive tickets, he wrote in and he said, I've never heard of the ABCs you've referred to. He had no idea what we were talking about.
Really?
Yeah. So
he's never seen a hard copy of the New York Times, I guess.
Exactly.
All right. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, my name is James Marino, and thank you so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.